Gladys.
We have a list on our website, warrockandajax.com, called Every Story Ever. What we're doing is we're taking lists from our listeners of three comic book stories, and then we are placing those stories on the list from best to worst comic book stories of all time. Howdy, folks. Welcome to yet another Every Story Ever monthly special here on War Rocket Ajax. These specials are made possible by our backers on Patreon. We appreciate them greatly, and you should too, because you get these because of them. Now, you probably got a good idea of how Every Story Ever works based on the opening theme music that we now have for these monthly shows. So I will do away with all that preamble explaining how this works. And Chris, I say let's just jump in and see how many of these lists we can get through in an hour.
Let's do it.
Our first list comes from David Cooter. Quater? I'm never sure how to say his name. But he is a line stepper, and we appreciate all he does for us.
It's a weirdly formal way of saying that, but yes, it is also 100% true.
And his list is called the How is Scott Pilgrim Not on This List?
Okay.
And the first one he has is Scott Pilgrim, which has got to lead us to determining whether Scott Pilgrim is one story or six individual volumes that we're going to have to put on here.
Now, Matt, what would be your argument on that? Where do you stand?
I feel like it does work as one big story.
Yeah, I mean, like, I would say, like, they made it into one movie, and they didn't cut a whole lot out.
I mean, they had to totally just make up Volume 6.
Yes.
But, yes, it's pretty much all in there in one movie.
Scott Pilgrim reads very much as a single beginning, middle, end story, just broken into six big, big chapters.
Right, and it's kind of a play in seven acts or six acts, I guess.
And the interesting thing is, like, when you think about the books that have come out like that, like, really the only other one that I can think of, other than like a manga, like as far as Western comics, really the only other one is Empowered, which I think does have a distinct, at least one distinct arc with it.
Right. Scott Pilgrim is clearly one big story. I think we can agree on that. So
yeah, I think we're coming down volumes 1 through 6 of Scott Pilgrim.
This is a comic that I think both of us like a whole bunch.
Mm-hmm. Very much. Now, we should disclaim that I also had a graphic novel release from Oni Press. So heads up, they're the publishers of Scott Pilgrim.
I think it's going to be hard to rank also because comparing it against some of the other stuff on here, it's a little tough. Do you think there's a neighborhood that it probably goes in?
I don't know that we've done anything that's comparable, like subject wise. Like there's some things that it weirdly feels like. Like, I want to say it kind of feels like Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck, but I don't think, no disrespect to...
That's a little weird, but I get it, yeah.
Well, but you get it, right? Like, single story, charting someone's personal growth, kind of putting together the bits and pieces of pop culture. In Life and Times, it's very focused on Karl Barks. In Scott Pilgrim, it's very wide. It's music, it's video games, it's stuff that you care about in your 20s. Like,
I mean, in that sense, it's kind of like Zot. It's kind of like, I mean, Howard the Duck is a little different, but
I mean, I feel like Zot is more of a, like, I feel like you're right. Like, I can see where you're coming from, but I feel like Zot is more of a, in a lot of ways is more about using the form, like the, using the medium than Scott Pilgrim.
Okay. Yeah, I get that.
But I don't think you're wrong. Now, I would say, I'd say it's not as good as Life and Times. You know that I am a big supporter of Life and Times.
Sure.
But I'd say it's probably better than Zod, which is a book that I like a lot.
Okay, one that's kind of in the middle of those that is also very strangely comparable is Bone. In that it's kind of one big story.
Yeah.
Very different genre. But
very different genre. And Bone is weirdly more like Life and Times.
Yeah.
But Bone also has a big tone shift in the middle. Like it no longer is the story that it starts off as.
Right.
That Scott Pilgrim does not have.
Yeah, Scott Pilgrim has a little bit of a tone shift in that it gets more serious because Scott gets more serious, right?
Yes.
But it is of a piece. It is one consistent story, very clearly and definitely.
Now, I do think Scott Pilgrim is better than Bone.
Okay, here's what we have directly above Bone. OMAC Volume 1, Sleeper, Deadshot, 1 through 4, Invincible Iron Man Annual Number 1, Kraven's Last Hunt, and Starman. Those are some of the things above it.
Yeah, no, oddly enough, Starman, also very comparable to Scott Pilgrim.
Weirdly, very weirdly.
Weirdly, very comparable. And not too much longer.
Side note, somebody asked me on Twitter the other day why my new Twitter handle wasn't weirdly comparable. At weirdly comparable.
That would be a good one.
Yeah.
I liked at not the colorist, too.
Yeah, that's the one I definitely should have done. But too late.
Okay, here's the thing. My instinct is to say Scott Pilgrim's better than Bone.
Yeah.
But there are things under Bone that my instinct would be like, no, Scott Pilgrim's not better than that. Scott Pilgrim's not better than Robin Dies at Dawn. Also Copra, weirdly comparable, at weirdly comparable on Twitter. because it, you know, Scott Pilgrim is very much a single vision of Brian Lee O'Malley kind of doing whatever he wants,
sure,
bringing in all of his influences. Copra, same way with Michel Fife. Do you think I'm right on the initial thought that it should go above Bone? Because I don't think, again, I like that book a lot, and there are few titles that I have been as excited as when they got a release date, when they were solicited, when they came out.
Yeah, I remember going and buying, you know, Scott Pilgrim volumes 4, 5, 6, like, you know, the day they were available. I don't know. Do we think it's better than OMAC, Jack Kirby OMAC?
I don't.
I mean, it's certainly not. It doesn't push the boundary. It's not experimental like OMAC is.
I mean, but it is weirdly experimental for a Western comic to be as popular as it was.
It does a type of storytelling that you don't see in comics a lot.
Mm-hmm. Also, we should say, are we taking into account the Nathan Fairbairn colored versions that were slightly redrawn? Or are we just going with original black and white manga size Scott Pilgrim?
I haven't read the reprints.
Well, they look good. They look real good.
I've seen art from them, and they do look good. But my frame of reference is the black and white original manga sized books. Let's just put it between OMAC Volume 1 and Bone.
Okay, so you are definitely saying I am right in that initial thought that
I think
it's better than Bone.
I think you are.
Okay.
And I don't know. Like, I think we're going to hem and haw about this. We could hem and haw about it forever.
I mean, look, it's been a while since I've read those books, but like I said, you know, there was a time when those were my favorite comics.
Sure. All right, the next one on the list is by a friend of ours, so we're going to have to take that into account. Atomic Robo Volume 1.
That's a good comic. That's a very, very good comic.
It's a very good comic.
Again, comics by a friend of ours, Scott Wigner.
Yep. And frenemy, Brian Clevenger.
Frenemy, Brian Clevenger. Multiple time guest on the show, Brian Clevenger. Again, like when that book started coming out, I was like, oh, this is it. This is my favorite comic. And it gets so much right in that first volume.
Yes.
Like, looking back, that first volume is really basic. Because it had to be, you know? Like, looking back, that volume is set in the present. It's Atomic Robo. It's the fighting scientists of Tessalonine. It's, you know, it is basic. Because it's laying the groundwork for a series that does everything.
Yeah, it does a really good job of setting up what is to come, which is a lot of jumping around in time, a lot of adventuring, like world-spanning adventuring, setting up the weird, crazy villains that show up throughout the series.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of heavy lifting in that first volume that you don't even really see until you go read the later volumes.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I really love the art style, like how it's drawn when Hellboy is summoned in that opening chapter, and when he wait, which one are we talking about? Which one is it?
Which volume?
I'm kidding. That's my joke about how everybody said Atomic Robo Volume 1 was just like Hellboy.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But yeah, like, really, like, I have spoken in the past about how there are certain comic book characters that I love primarily because you can do anything with them, right? Like, mm-hmm. Scrooge McDuck, if there's a treasure, you know, anything that is monetarily valuable, he can be in that story. Batman, anything that is considered an illegal act, a crime of any kind, Batman can go and do that thing. Atomic Robo, from day one, is the same way. And from day one is exactly that kind of character. And in fact, like that first issue, that very first issue does take place in 1938. It's an early story.
Right.
And I believe that's the story of it's the story of how Robo is declared human, right? Or is that the story where he goes to Mars?
I think you're right. It's been a while since I've read that first volume, but I think you're right. I know that there's that flashback at the beginning for sure.
Yeah. But, like, from the start, there's this idea of, okay, he can do anything. He can go anywhere. He can, you know, anything that can be classified as action science, any monster, any Nazi, any weird thing is his. And the second issue of Atomic Robo, one of the best pages I think I've ever read. Which is the page where Robo talks about how the hardest thing about being an immortal robot from the 20s is that he is, you know, nobody gets his Jack Benny jokes anymore. Which is such a, like, it's like funny, but it's sad in a, like, really, like, engaging way. And, you know, the letter that he writes to, you know, his friend from the 30s who died, like, that first book, and again, Brian has been on the show. Scott played in my D&D group for a little while, so they're friends of ours. But honest to God, that book should be taught in comic schools. You need to go back to comic school and read that book and talk about, like, how perfectly it's everything's set up. It's really great. It is really great.
All right, where does it go on the list?
I mean, it should probably go pretty high. Now, the question is, do you think it's the best Atomic Robo story?
No.
What do you think the best one is?
I don't know. That's a tough one. Do you have a favorite?
Or, like,
the one that you think is demonstrably the best?
What was it called? The She-Devils of the Pacific? That one's really good.
That one's really fun, yeah.
The time travel story with the multiple robos fighting Cthulhu monsters, the one where H.P. Lovecraft shows up and starts shouting super racist things.
That one, that's, weirdly enough, might be my favorite one, just because...
I mean, that's, like, the most technically impressive and also has probably the funniest gag.
Yeah. And you know, it's a special thing for like people with a familiarity with Lovecraft. Yeah, I do like that one a lot.
The Atomic Robo Volume 1 lays a lot of groundwork, but like, gosh, it's like that is a, you know, we had this conversation about Usagi Yojimbo, where it's like that's a series that there's been a lot of them, and there ain't a bad one,
right?
Like, it's hard to it's really hard to split hairs on that. I'm just saying, like, if somebody sends us Atomic Robo Volume 4 or whatever, like, are we going to are we going to regret putting the first volume this high?
Yeah, that is my concern as well.
And we should say, if you have not read Atomic Robo, Brian Clevenger did a very, very smart thing, which is that he put they're all available on Comixology. They are, you know, collected on Comixology. They are also all available to read as a webcomic, like, for free. You can just read them, including the new stuff. That's really good. Like, so I would say volume one has got to go pretty high, though.
All right. I'm looking at an area of the list that has several volume ones of books.
Okay, let's see if we're looking at around the same place.
We've got Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, number 1-7. Not far below that is Empire Volume 1.
Mm-hmm.
And then not far below that is Casanova Volume 1.
Now, Casanova's ambitious.
Yep.
And Casanova's very good. Like, that, you know, this ain't a bad neighborhood of the list. But I think Atomic Robo clicks a little more than Casanova. I think Atomic Robo is a little more engaging than Empire, and I think it's more polished than TMNT. But I think you could also argue that all three of those could be considered better.
I think they're more... Not to say that Robo isn't fully formed in its first volume, because it surprisingly is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were going to make an Atomic Robo movie, is that the story you would do?
That's an interesting question. Like, if you were going to give somebody one Atomic Robo story?
Yeah, because Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that's the basis for that movie, right?
Yeah. And it's like we said when we talked about it, it's the story they keep going back to. It's the story that they keep drawing on those elements.
If I was going to make an Empire movie, that's the one I would make. If I was going to make a Casanova movie, that's the one I would make.
I would love to see that movie.
Yeah.
I would love to see that weird thing happen.
But I think if I was going to place it just right now, I think I'd put it between Empire and Ghost World.
I think that's a good place for it.
Okay.
Although I would argue Atomic Robo Volume 1 is better than I Kill Giants, although probably not as emotionally affecting.
I think what put I Kill Giants in the place that it's on our list is sort of the emotional element of it.
Right. It definitely has that emotional impact. Also beautiful art.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to put it under Empire Volume 1?
And above Ghost World.
Okay.
All right, the last one on David's list is Little Nemo in Slumberland, the Winsor McCay original version.
I have not read many of those. I have not read enough of those to make a judgment.
Me neither. I've read some strips, but I've not read the entire story.
Yeah, we're going to have to knock that one off the list because we are unqualified on that one.
All right, that takes care of that. Next list we have comes from Ryan Hillis, who is trying us with another list after he sent us a list where we said one of his submissions was too big. He needed to break it up.
Do you remember what it was?
It was the entirety of ROM Space Knight.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's okay.
Now he is asking us to rank ROM Space Knight numbers 1 through 25.
I believe that is actually what we suggested that he send in.
Yeah.
which is hilarious. All right. Now, Matt, how familiar are you with, if are the next ones on the list ROM Space Knight 26 through 50 and ROM Space Knight 51 through 75?
No, it's just this is the only okay. ROM on his submission.
Okay. Now, Matt, have you read ROM Space Knight 1 through 25?
I don't think I've read all of those issues. I've read maybe like the first 10. Mm-hmm. So this one's going to have to be all you.
Okay. The basic thing that happens in these issues, you know, a lot of stuff happens in this. This is 2 years plus of Bronze Age comics, so a hell of a lot happens in these comics. Basically, ROM the Space Knight comes to Earth to fight the Dire Wraiths. The Dire Wraiths are an offshoot of the Skrulls. They're shapeshifters who also do magic. ROM is a cyborg who gave up his humanity to fight in this war for thousands of years. He's been tracking these monsters across the galaxy for thousands of years. What happens is that ROM fights a bunch of Dire Wraiths on Earth, meets the X-Men, does all that cool stuff, fights a woolly mammoth, uppercuts him. It's great. Then he goes back to Galador, which is the planet where he's from, and he finds out that the war is over. Like, the Dire Wraiths have been conquered. It's, weirdly enough, exactly what Alan Moore does in Wildcats in the 90s. and he finds out that someone had himself rebuilt as ROM. So there's two ROMs. There's the real ROM and then a fake ROM. Who is claiming to be the hero, who is basically in charge of Galador. Then Galactus shows up and tries to eat Galador, and that's what's in ROM number 25. So it's this big space opera that really, like, takes a huge twist that, for its time, is pretty great. Like, that's a really cool idea. And then it takes that huge twist, and then also Galactus shows up. And then ROM, who's been fighting this war against the Dire Wraith, goes, "Hey, Galactus, you want to eat Galador? Well, how about I lead you to the home planet of the Dire Wraiths, and you can eat them?" And ROM is basically going to commit genocide on the Dire Wraiths because he's been at war with them for thousands of years. And then it turns out that the Dire Wraith's home planet is poison. And Galactus can't eat it, so Galactus, fucks off back to the rest of the galaxy. It's like, so many good ideas. Like, so many ideas that read, honest to God, like they are 20 years ahead of their time.
Yeah.
Like, Bill Mantlo is doing Warren Ellis shit in those comics. In that weird toy comic that can never be reprinted.
Yeah.
So yeah, ROM 1 through 25 are fucking awesome. ROM 1 through 75 are actually fucking awesome, too. But, like, those first 25 are kind of like that one unifying story of ROM, you know, being this weird warrior for this ancient war that he doesn't know is over, that he's going to keep on fighting, and using Galactus as a weapon. Like, I honestly don't think anyone had come up with the idea of using Galactus as a weapon before. Bill Mantlo was ahead of his time. Bill Mantlo is amazing and underrated. And as you probably know, if you read Comics Alliance, every time we mention Bill Mantlo, he was, the co-creator of Rocket Raccoon. He was the victim of a hit and run accident that left him brain damaged, in need of constant medical care. So if you are a fan of Bill Mantlo, which I am, if you think that sounds like a cool idea, and you want to support Mantlo, you can very easily find the fund that goes to his brother who is responsible for his care. And I would suggest that you do so. If you have not already, I know that when Guardians came out, there was a big push to help out with Mantlo. But it's always worth mentioning anytime he comes up that dude gave a lot of really cool stuff to comics. And, comics has kind of stepped up to give back to him. But that's still ongoing work that we can do, I think, is the way to put it. But yeah,
yes, absolutely.
Those 25 issues, great, great comics.
All right, I'm leaving it entirely up to you to rank it.
Okay, well, right now, kind of the Bronze Age Marvel stuff that we have, we've got Squadron Supreme, which is from a little bit later.
Right.
Rom is the early 80s, you know, I think it starts in 79, so it's early 80s.
We've got some Tomb of Dracula on here.
We've got some TOD. We've got Devil Dinosaur, obviously.
Yep.
Rom 1 through 25 are a lot like Squadron Supreme 1 through 12. Both very, very ahead of their time. Both interesting products of an interesting time in Marvel Comics history. It's hard to say that Rom 1 through 25 would be better than Squadron Supreme. Because again, Rom 1 through 25 were not necessarily written as a single cohesive story.
Right.
Like, you know, they did not know how long they were going to be publishing Rom. They certainly, I am sure, did not know they were going to be publishing it for 75 issues. I don't know. I think it's better than Secret Wars. So I think going between, I don't think it's as good as Doom Quest. So that puts it in a really interesting place. I think it's better than Aerosmith, not as good as Final Crisis. That's going to be my final judgment on that.
All right. That is where that's going to go.
Yeah. Aerosmith is prettier, though.
Aerosmith is a beautiful comic. The next one on Ryan's list is Ghost Rider Volume 4, number 20 through 35. That is Jason Aaron's run on Ghost Rider.
Oh, man. That's a good-ass comic.
Those are some fun comics.
Those comics are great. Like, one of those comics ends with four different groups of people, and it's this serial killer who is a born-again Christian serial killer. So there's a part where Ghost Rider's fighting him, and this guy's, like, super big and super tough, and, like, I think he's got superpowers, but Ghost Rider, like, ends up picking up a Bible, and the guy won't hit him while he's holding the Bible, so Ghost Rider beats him to death with the Bible, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, it's full of stuff like that. So it's him. It's a bunch of, like, sexy nuns with guns. It's somebody else. I think it's... Is it Zadkiel, maybe? And it's Ghost Rider, you know, Johnny Blaze. And they're all doing stuff. And then the shot pulls back, and they're literally driving down four roads to meet each other at an intersection in this town. Mm-hmm. Like, they're all coming together in this town, and the shit is about to jump off. And that's one of those last pages where it's like you throw the book up in the air, and you're like, oh, you do a regular show thing. Those comics are fun as hell, man. That Jason Aaron Ghost Rider.
They're very fun. I don't think they're anywhere close to being the best Jason Aaron comics. If anything, they're kind of like Jason Aaron doing a riff on Garth Ennis.
I don't necessarily think that's what it is so much as it's Aaron and Ghost Rider. Yeah, you know, Ghost Rider's comics that he did. Ghost Rider's mini comics. I don't think it's that as much as it's Aaron and Ennis both drawing from that same pool of influences, that same, you know, Sam Peckinpah ass aesthetic that they both kind of go for in a lot of places.
Yeah. I mean, I see that. I can't help but feel that it's a little bit of a riff on Ennis. Just Ennis is Punisher more than anything, weirdly. But, you know, maybe I'm assigning that to it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, yeah, there's certainly a... Like, you could certainly draw that comparison. I actually think it's very comparable. I also think it suffers a little bit from the art. Ten Eng Huat starts that book, and I'm not, like, a huge fan of his work. It's got those, you know, Marko Djurjevic covers.
Yeah.
But I think Ten Ing Huat draws most of that run. And weirdly enough, like, I'm not a huge fan of his. His style does work really well for that book.
Yeah, it's got a grittiness to it that I think works.
And there are, you know, Tony Moore issues in there as well that, you know, have the Hell Truck from US 1 shows up in those. Those are great.
Yeah.
The Orb. Is it the Orb gets, like, the Orb and Master Pandemonium are, like, they're great villains in that run, which is something that you could never say before.
I think the run falls under fun, but comparatively unimportant compared to other Ghost Rider comics and other Jason Aaron comics. Like, we're not talking about Scalped here. We're not even talking about Jason Aaron's Punisher run here. Like, those are two. Thor, his Thor run. Like, those are all more important Jason Aaron comics.
Yeah, but I do think this is an underrated Jason Aaron comic. Like, this, like, if you became a fan of Aaron's from Thor, if you became a fan of Aaron's from, I mean, probably if you were reading his Punisher run, you're probably reading this. They happened around the same time. But, like, especially if you're a fan of Southern Bastards, like, you're going to like this Ghost Rider run. It's not, it's, like, tonally completely different. It's, like, slapstick. But it's the same, you know, like, you're going to like it. Like, you're going to have fun with it.
Yeah.
I think it's underrated, but I think you're right that it's unimportant. But it's, I almost feel like it's a formative work for Jason Aaron. Or, like, a formative work for Jason Aaron's superhero stuff. Like, he had obviously done almost all of Scalped by the time Ghost Rider was coming out, I think. If my memory is correct, I could be completely wrong on that.
I think Scalped was finishing up by that time. Or
this would have been...
It was well into the run of Scalped.
2008 was when that started?
Well...
So... Scalped was what?
It was... Scalped was... Maybe...
Well,
Scalped
was started in 2007, so
yeah,
this would have been...
Yeah, it was only a couple
of
arcs in at that point. They were running pretty concurrently.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm looking in the neighborhood of, like, Godzilla 1 through 17.
Oh, perfect place for it. Perfect place for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, because what we have around that, we've got that Tomb of Dracula story that's really good.
That
we have
Hero
Smacks.
For Hire story. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say it's better than Godzilla, but not as good as Tomb of Dracula.
Done. Done and done. It is on the list. All right. The last one on Ryan's list is Fofford and the Grey Mauser by Howard Chaykin and Mike Mignola.
Yeah, that book's the shit. No, this is interesting, though, because is this the first adaptation that we've ever put on the list?
I mean, we've done licensed comics.
Yeah, but this is like that Fofford and the Grey Mauser story, I believe, because I'm pretty sure it's got the story of Fofford and the Grey Mauser stealing the gazebo in there.
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah.
They steal a fucking house, guys. It's awesome. I'm pretty sure it's a straight adaptation of Fritz Lieber's novel, like the first Fofford and the Grey Mauser novel.
Yeah. This may be the first, like, just full on adaptation that we've ranked.
Yeah, I don't think we've got any other ones on here. That's really interesting, because this is a this is an awesome adaptation because it's drawn by Mike Mignola,
yeah,
and written by Howard Chaykin,
yeah,
adapting a story that's pretty good to begin with. If you don't know Fofford and the Grey Mauser, series of novels by Fritz Lieber that usually they're titled Swords Against Something, Swords Against Magic, Swords Against Deviltry, and it's about these two guys. Fofford is this big barbarian, like this big, like, Conan-ass dude.
He's the Viking from, what is that game? Golden Axe?
Yeah. Yeah,
the dwarf or the Viking. He's taller, but he's that archetype.
Yeah, he's the strong, you know, Cimmerian, who comes down from the ice, and the Grey Mauser is like a little skinny, like a little skinny tweaker.
He's the
like a little
he's,
skinny thief.
He's thief, yeah.
And they're shitty guys. Like, they're horrible. They're like, in the way that Conan is a shitty dude, like in the way that Conan like will go steal some shit from a guy and then go get drunk, but we kind of like him because, you know, fuck the rich. Like, Favre and the Grey Mauser are exactly that kind of shitty.
Right.
And, like, in this story, they steal a house. Like, there's a nobleman who has, like, a little... it's referred to as a cottage or a gazebo in the book. But it's a structure in his lawn. And Favre and the Grey Mauser get drunk as hell, go to his house in the middle of the night, and steal it. And put it in an alley, and then throw a bunch of trash on it and live there. They're the best.
They're kind of the basis of what I say is always my favorite, not the basis, but a version of what I say is my favorite archetypal character, which is the ineffectual scoundrel, even though they are pretty effectual. Like, they're actually pretty good at their jobs.
I mean, the end of that story is, like, and again, like, consider that this is a pretty old story, like, you know, from, I think they were written in the 70s, maybe?
Not as old as some stories.
No, like, that's as far back as they go. Tale as old as time, man. Let's see. Favre and the Grey Mauser, 64. The first story is in 64, and I think the collection occurs in 1970, according to Wikipedia.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, like, pretty old, but, you know, a woman gets killed. And they end up going on a fucking rampage and killing a cult. Like, an entire cult.
Right.
Like, they're badasses at the end of the day. But yeah, they're two shitty dudes who get drunk and fight wizards, which is, like, the best thing.
And then,
it's a great sword and sorcery book.
This adaptation, which I think was from Dark Horse, it was released in 2007. So that's how far ago, how long ago that came out.
Well, no, it was, that's the collection of it. It was originally from the 90s.
Much older than that, the 90s?
Yeah.
All right, because I picked up the collection when it came out. That's how I've read it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was actually published by DC, maybe? DC, or maybe licensed it? But yeah, that Dark Horse reproduction was when Dark Horse got the license back from.
Okay.
Or no, it was from Epic. It was from Epic.
Okay. That clears that all up.
Yeah, and it's Mike Mignola doing an adaptation, which is beautiful.
It looks like, so good. It looks so good, and that story is really cool.
And like, there was a time in this world, Matt, where Mike Mignola was not only drawing monthly comics, he was drawing monthly licensed comics. Like, he drew the adaptation of Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. Like,
yeah, I remember that.
I like to call it, like, I've got that book. I like to call it Roy Thomas and Mike Mignola's Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. It's beautiful. It is unbelievably gorgeous.
All right. Here's the point where I have to bring this up. Must we disqualify this? Because it is an adaptation of a novel or of a prose story.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is called Every Story Ever. We're ranking stories. And this story isn't native to comics. Howard Chaykin and Mike Mignola merely adapted it.
I was born to it. Howard Chaykin and Mike Mignola merely adapted it.
I don't think so. I don't think, like, I think it is a comics adaptation. Like, it, now, again, this is called Every Story Ever. We're limiting ourselves to one particular medium. It is every comic book story.
Right.
But as long as this falls within that medium, which it does, it is a transformative work in a lot of ways. You know, that book doesn't have Mike Mignola in it.
That's fair, yeah.
The book sure as hell doesn't have Mike Mignola in it. I think this qualifies. I think if we did, like, if people wanted to send in the Peter David Russ Heath Rocketeer movie adaptation, which is the one that I have a lot of fond memories of from when I was a kid, I think that would be fair game, even though that's an adaptation of an adaptation, even.
Right. It's an adaptation of an adaptation of a comic.
Yes.
Which is extra weird.
Yeah.
Okay. Then where does this go? I think this is very difficult to rank because it is not an original to comics story.
It's not an original to comics story, but it holds up. I mean, you thought it was from at least 10 years after it was from.
Yeah, I mean, because that's when I read it. Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, it's good. I would say it's... I think it certainly goes in the top half of the list. I don't know how far into the top half it's going to go. Like, I think right now, about our midpoint on this list, which should tell you how good this, you know, the comics are that we have... Our midpoint is Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Trinity, the Matt Wagner story.
That might actually even be a little below the midpoint. I think our midpoint is closer to, like, Planet Hulk or
Planet Terror. You know, that's a story we like.
Yeah.
I think this is definitely better than Trinity.
Yeah.
I think it's... I think it's better than Power Girl. I would put it as better than We Three. I don't think I would put it above Birthright.
Okay. I think that's fine. Our final list is from Benito Sereno.
Ooh, friend of the show, friend of ours.
Personal friend of ours. Here, I'm just going to read his email, okay?
Okay.
Matt, all capital letters. Here is a list for you. I sent it because I can't believe you haven't done these stories yet. The theme of my list is, you come at the king, you best not miss.
Okay.
Here are the stories.
Before you say the stories, can I just say, this is two lists we've done on the show where people can't believe we haven't done them yet.
Yeah.
I just want to say, that's out of our hands, guys. That's out of our hands, folks. Like you're the one sending them in. So
I mean, I'm selecting the lists to do, but yes, I don't believe I've seen these. I don't believe that I've seen these on any other lists sent in. All right, here's number one: Amazing Spider-Man number 229 through 230. Nothing can stop the Juggernaut.
Stop the Juggernaut.
That shit's good.
Yeah, that's the second best Spider-Man story.
Yep. And what's the best Spider-Man story? Number one on
Spider-Man
our list.
Best Spider-Man story is the number one comic on the list.
Yep.
Man, if people haven't read the story, it is Roger Stern and John Romita Jr. The Juggernaut attacks New York. He's not even attacking New York. He's just walking straight through it.
Yeah,
his way to go beat the shit out of somebody.
He's on his way to beat the shit out of someone and do some crimes. And Spider-Man's just going to stop him. And he cannot. Until he walks him into some cement being poured.
Yeah, and like... If you read Roger Stern's run on Spider-Man as a whole, which you should, it's great.
Listen,
Stern is...
How many times have we said, on these Every Story Ever segments, I believe, Roger Stern is super underrated?
Yeah, the most underrated Spider-Man writer possibly of all time. Possibly of all time. And if you read his run, like, he has kind of a recurring theme in his run where he like wants to remind you that Spider-Man's really strong. Because when you think about it, being able to lift 20 times your body weight is fucking ridiculous. Like the only thing that keeps him from being like impressive with that is that you know, the Thing exists.
And Thor exists.
The Hulk exists.
Yeah.
Like, but Stern likes to kind of remind you, yeah, Spider-Man can throw a car. Like, Spider-Man can pick up a car and throw it.
And he's a guy who weighs, like, you know, $1.50.
Yeah. He can, you know, he's a strong guy. He can jump 30 feet in the air. He can, you know, do amazing things. So Stern spends time kind of reminding you about this, and the fucking Juggernaut shows up, and then nothing can stop the Juggernaut.
He puts the biggest possible obstacle in the way of Spider-Man.
Yeah, he puts it, and Spider-Man spends, like, two issues trying to outstrong him. Until
there's a great spread where Spider-Man is just jumping all around the Juggernaut, and this is all in one panel. So it's that thing where it's kind of like an outline of Spider-Man to show you where he has been, but it's not where he actually is in the panel.
Mm-hmm.
And he has gone around every angle of the Juggernaut to try to stop him. And you just see the Juggernaut continuing to walk forward.
Yeah, and this story is like, he's going after Madame Web, is what he's doing.
That's right.
The Juggernaut's going after Madame Web. Like, this story, should you doubt how kind of influential this story was, like, when they made that Spider-Man game for the Dreamcast, and I think this has shown up in every Spider-Man video game since, like, they base some of his attacks on attacks he does in this comic. This comic is influential because this comic is great.
That Spider-Man game is so good.
The Dreamcast Spider-Man game is great, man.
The one that was on the PlayStation and they ported to the Dreamcast. But
Dreamcast version was superior. better graphics. Like, this has some of, like, the most innovative stuff. Like, Spider-Man building the big catapult or the slingshot at the construction site with his webs and launching girders at Juggernaut.
Yes.
Like, that shit that would come back, like, in the late 90s, like, during the Mark of Cain stuff, like, in the mid-90s.
What's so bananas is that this isn't only a defining story for Spider-Man. It's the defining story for the Juggernaut.
Yes.
Who is an X-Men character, but so much of what has come to define the Juggernaut comes from this Spider-Man story.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. And like, the solution to it is so clever. And, you know, the other thing about Peter Parker, you know, the other thing about Spider-Man is that Peter Parker is a genius and Spider-Man kind of isn't. Peter Parker is a nerd, and then he puts on a mask and becomes a jock. You know, he punches people out and makes fun of them. that's kind of, you know, the thing about Spider-Man. Like, he's really sassy and quippy when he's got his mask on, but when it's off, he's, you know, Peter Parker. he's nerdy, unreliable Pete. And so, like, the solution that he comes up with is a Peter Parker solution.
Yes.
And it's so hard to write a smart character like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about Roger Stern on Spider-Man, is that, yes, he emphasized that Spider-Man was strong, but he also emphasized that Spider-Man was smart. And that Peter Parker was, you know, an actual science genius, which is another thing that sometimes gets lost in Spider-Man comics. There's often a focus on one aspect of a character instead of showing them as a rounded person at all times, you know?
Yeah. Also, the cover for I'm actually reading Spider-Man 230 right now, because I've got that I've got all the PDFs from when Marvel was selling those DVDs a few years ago.
Yeah.
Which, if you can find them, get those. They're great. Because they're like actual scans cover to cover of all the comics with the ads and everything in them. It's awesome. But the cover, like, the covers for those two comics are great. Like, 229's cover is Juggernaut in silhouette, and it says nothing can stop the Juggernaut. And it's, you know, Peter and Madame Web, or Spidey and Madame Web in front. And that's a really cool cover. But the cover for number 230 is this giant black and white, like, newsprint-style close-up of the Juggernaut's face with these bloodshot eyes and this massive mouth, and then Spider-Man swinging right at him in color. It's one of my favorite covers of all time.
It's really so good. Great. Everything about those two issues is so good.
They don't suck.
All right. Where do we put them?
Okay. Well, it's the second best Spider-Man story of all time, so it can't go at number one.
It cannot go at number one. That's right.
Okay. But it's like, again, it's going to go high, but right now our top 10 is kind of untouchable.
Yeah. It's hard, like, to penetrate that top 10.
It's, but at the same time, like, I feel like those two issues in their way are as good as Born Again. Like, but, I mean, they're not.
No.
You know, they're great, but they're not, like, they're not transcendent, I guess is the way to put it. Like, they're as good as monthly superhero comics can get while being monthly superhero stories, if that makes sense. You know?
Yeah. Those two issues define the Juggernaut, but they don't define anybody else. And so many of the other top issues we have here are very character defining, right?
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, like, why
Batman,
I think
Year
it,
One
I don't,
is
I don't think it's above This Man, This Monster, for example.
Yeah, I think you're right. But, like, again, it doesn't suck.
It does not suck. I think, okay, talk about character defining. Like, Triumph and Torment, which is another Roger Stern comic.
Yeah.
I think is better because it is so illuminating about Doctor Doom, right?
And Doctor Strange.
Sure.
Like, I would say if there is a such thing as a definitive Doctor Strange story, that's kind of it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that and the one where he goes and yells at Eternity, I guess.
I think it might go right under that.
Yeah, because what we have under that is...
Next Wave,
Winter Soldier, Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck, and Preacher. Like, those are the ones directly under that. And Welcome Back, Frank, and Dark Phoenix Saga are under that. The only one, like, I would say Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck is, like, if you only read one of the hundreds of Uncle Scrooge stories, like, hundreds of Duck stories, that's the one to read. But also it's kind of contingent on a larger knowledge.
Right.
If you read two Spider-Man stories, this is the second one. So, like, I don't know how those shake out. Like, I feel like you're right that it goes right below Triumph and Torment. But, I think it's better than Winter Soldier, which is weird, because Winter Soldier is a good-ass comic.
I think it's better than Winter Soldier, too.
Okay, can we talk about downsides of this comic real quick?
Sure.
Okay. You mentioned that it defines the Juggernaut, but it doesn't really define anyone else. It's a good Peter Parker story, but it's not a definitive one. The final chapter is a definitive Spider-Man, like Peter.
Sure, absolutely.
John Romita Jr.'s art in this is great, but it's also, he's not John Romita Jr. yet. It's still early enough in his career. Like we were actually talking about this over the weekend, Chad and I, because someone started talking to us about John Romita Jr. for some reason. And we were talking about how John Romita Jr. kind of becomes John Romita Jr. that we know today in Man Without Fear. Like, that's where there's a massive stylistic shift that
it's,
he's kept
it's,
for.
Well, that's where John Romita Jr. like adds that Frank Miller thing to his art that has been there
right.
ever since. Yeah.
Right. So, like, I don't think, like, again, this is not a bad-looking comic by any means, but it's interesting that this is not, you know, but I don't think it's John Romita Jr.'s best work. I think there's stuff he does on X-Men that's better. I think there's stuff he does on Daredevil that's better. I think there's, you know, I think there's stuff
some,
he does on.
I think there's some really good looking art in those two issues, though. Like I said, I talked about that spread where he's jumping all around the Juggernaut in all those different ways.
Yeah. I mean, look. It does not look bad, but I think you do have to take into account that John Romita Jr. did go through a stylistic shift after this comic.
Sure.
But again, like those are the only downsides to this book. That's it. So yeah, I think you're right. I think above Next Wave, under Triumph and Torment.
Okay. The next one, and we have talked about how much we love this story. Superman number 156, The Last Days of Superman. Now, I thought we had ranked this because it is the number one quote on our World Heavyweight Champions list.
Uh-huh.
But we have not actually ranked the story.
This is the day where we're doing a lot of stories we like to talk about.
Yeah.
But boy, howdy. That is a good, good comic. Is not a dream, is not a hoax. It is the last days. It is a hoax, I guess.
Yeah.
what number is it?
Not an imaginary story. 156.
156. Yeah, this is really good. It's a really good this is so hard. The Last Days of Superman is a story where Superman gets kryptonite poisoning. He has 30 days left to live. So he goes around the world and fixes everything and then goes off to die.
And he carves a message into the moon about how do good to others and every man can be a Superman.
Yeah. You may recognize this as literally the story of All-Star Superman. All-Star Superman is based on this issue.
Yeah.
It's based on a couple of different things from the Silver Age, but primarily All-Star Superman is the modern age retelling of this story. And this story, like, All-Star Superman's not better, you know? All-Star Superman's newer and probably, like, more thoughtfully constructed, but it ain't better. Like,
well, you're drawing yourself into a corner here, because we have All-Star Superman number 5 on our list right now. The comic that you have said is the best single issue of all time is below that.
Look, I may have exaggerated. I'm just glad G.I. Joe number 21 hasn't been on this list yet, because I would just have to thoroughly remove any pretense that I am definitive and not just that's not just a comic I really like from the mid-90s.
Right.
Last Days of Superman's really good, and it is weirdly not reprinted as often as you might think. I don't think it's in the 75 Years of Superman hardcover. I think that was one of my big...
It's not. You're correct.
Issues with it.
It's not in there.
Which, you know, how y'all gonna put Superman in there and not do this story? And also, it's a 3-part novel, so it's a full length story. It's, you know, in a time when most DC comics had 3 short stories in it, 3 8-pagers, or like 2 11-pagers, this comic is a full length issue. And everybody's in it. Jimmy, Lois, Lana, the Legion, Supergirl, Lex Luthor. Like, everybody's fucking in it. Lori Lamaris is in it. The Emergency Squad are in it. Like, it's one of the big... Like, Batman's in it. It's one of the biggest stories of its era. Like, this is an event comic. This is what an event comic looked like in 1962. Like, it's huge for its day. Some amazing art. I believe it's... again, I'm actually looking at the issue right now, and I don't think it's... I don't think Wayne Boring is credited. But I'm pretty sure it's Wayne Boring. but it's like so good. It's so good. And that, and that's on top of the message carved into the moon, which is our favorite comic book quote of all time.
At least so far.
So far.
And that it's that is going to be hard to remove from the top of that list.
You and Robin have been wonderful friends, Batman.
The penciler of The Last Days of Superman, Kurt Swan.
Okay, then that's the obvious choice. For some reason, I thought it was Wayne Boring.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
It's Kurt Swan.
But, like, that splash page, that opening splash page of all the tiny Kandorians, like, lifting Superman up by the cape and carrying him into the fortress because he can't stand, like, one of the, like we did an homage to that in Awesome Hospital. Like, that's one of the best.
Yeah, it's so good. All right, so are we sticking by that it's better than All-Star Superman?
I wish we could tie them, you know?
Yeah.
I wish we could tie them. Because I, honest to God, think it's better than Gotham Central. Like, and you know, I realize that I'm a dude who loves Silver Age Superman comics. So are you. So is Benito.
Yeah.
But this is one of the all-time greats. Like, an All-Star Superman would not exist if not for this comic.
I disagree with you, though. I think All-Star Superman is better. I think that All-Star Superman adds a kind of a modern layer of pathos to that Silver Age, story.
Really? Because, I mean, I actually think there's, like, kind of a lot of pathos in that original.
There,
like,
is. I mean, look,
but not,
there
but
is.
I, not the modern age comics.
But I don't think there's anything that matches up to the Superman flying at full speed across a cornfield and crying, talking about how he can save his dad, he can save everyone.
Yeah, I mean, yes, there's... Also, Superman gets to do more.
Yeah, he gets to go to Bizarro World and hear a guy say one of my favorite comic quotes of all time that I would love to see on the Word Heavyweight Champions list. Zibaro am king of cool.
He writes that message on the moon.
He does write that message on the moon.
Message on the moon, Matt.
He does. It's true.
You know who ain't in All-Star Superman? Brainiac 5.
That's true.
Brainiac 5 crying.
He is not in All-Star Superman.
Interestingly enough, like look, I think there's no getting around it. Last Days of Superman is top 10 material.
Yeah.
If we put it in the top 10, Superman will become the only character in two stories in the top 10, which right now is an honor that belongs to Batman, because Year One is number 2, and Dark Knight Returns is number 10.
Yeah, we're gonna make
it two.
And Gotham
Central is number 5.
That's technically Batman.
Yeah. So, are we putting it right under All Star Superman?
That's where I would put it.
Okay.
I mean, it took everything in my being to not put No One Can Stop the Juggernaut in the top 10.
Oh yeah, look, but No One Can Stop the Juggernaut is great.
But I think we reasoned out why it is not there.
Yeah, a lot of people have sent us their favorite comics, and like this list, we have said it. This list is top heavy, and then like you get to like Spider-Man 2099, and then like 10 steps down from Spider-Man 2099, everything's garbage.
Yeah,
everything's terrible. Like we
have a very small middle tier of mediocre stuff.
Yes.
All right, number 3. On Benito's
okay, last
list.
One. We'll blow through this.
We're not going to. It's Thor number 360 through 362, Into the Valley of Death.
Fuck. Okay. All right, this is the story where they go to hell.
Yep.
This is the story where there's... there's a big war, right? The culmination of Simonson's first year on that book is the big war in Asgard. it's a three-front war against Surtur. In that conflict, some mortals are taken to hell. So kind of the first thing that happens after that, like after Surtur is beaten, is that Thor has to go down to hell and fight.
Right.
To get the mortals back. And Scourge goes with him. Scourge doesn't come back.
Scourge does not come back, no.
But he holds the bridge, Matt.
That's right.
He holds the bridge. Now, we have talked about this story at length on the quote segment, because it was submitted, the page, the entire page of Scourge holding the bridge was sent in. This is a good, it's a good ass comic, man. God, it's so good. Like,
do you think this is the best story in the Simonson run?
Oh. Yeah? I guess? Because it is, like, Simonson runs full of great stories.
Oh, yeah.
Simonson runs full of, like, great individual stories. The story where Thor gets enchanted and he fought, like, you know, Loki makes him fall in love with Lorelei. And then at the end of it, he grabs Loki by the head and throws his hammer up in the air and says, hey, that hammer's coming back to my hand, even if your head's in the way. You better fucking undo the curse. That story's good. That issue that's 22 splash pages of Thor fighting the Midgard Serpent, where Thor hits a dragon so hard that he breaks every bone in his own body.
I mean,
that's a good story.
That shit is rad.
Yeah, that shit is, and that's the one where Simonson comes back. Like, Buscema had been drawing the book for a long time by that point, and Simonson comes back and draws that issue. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
The Bald of the Brave miniseries is a weird fairy tale, and it's great. The Beta Ray Bill stuff at the beginning is great. But yeah, that's the best. Into the Valley of Death is the best. Like, it's the best part of the best run. And I've said this before, Simonson's Thor is the single best run in comics history. Up to where the Zaniac shows up. And then it's bad for like 3 issues and then it gets good again. Like, fuck, man. this is so hard. But yeah, like, it's, I can't think of a part of that run that's better. Maybe the only moment that's better than Scourge holding the bridge, and this is debatable, but maybe the only one is Baldur picking up the sword again.
Yeah.
Like, and the thing is, like, when you start reading this book, people will tell you, like, hey man, let me know when Baldur takes up the sword. Hey, let me know when Scourge holds the bridge. And, like, go into that first issue, you don't know what those mean. Like, you don't know what it means when Baldur picks up a sword again. You don't know that he did not walk out, but swam through an ocean of blood to get out of hell.
But listen, Chris. He stood alone at Gallifrey.
Hey, man, they sing no songs in hell. Nor do they honor heroes. And look, I don't have that comic in front of me.
Come and get it, demons.
Oh,
tis Scourge's last laugh.
And it's like, and that page should be dumb as hell. That story should be dumb, right? Because it's like one of the things that happens is when the Vikings.
Well, he's shooting assault rifles.
Yeah, when the Vikings all go to Earth, they get M16s because they're like, yeah. Hey, you know, we need military help to fight all the, you know, Scourge and the demons from the Burning Galaxy. And so all the Vikings get M16s and they're like, hey, these are awesome. We're going to take some of these back to Asgard. And so it's a page of Scourge with an M16 in each hand, just mowing down demons.
Yes.
It should be dumb as hell. It will make you cry. All right. Shit. I'm just looking at the top 10. It's like,
but Nito knew he was going to do this to us.
Oh, what an asshole that guy. No, I love Benito. Benito's great. These are great. These are great comics. Okay. It's better than Supreme.
Is it better than Grasscutter?
God damn it.
Because, look, as much superlative stuff as we've said about this story, this Thor story, we probably said more superlative stuff about Grasscutter.
Yeah, well, that's because, you know, that's because everybody knows Walt Simonson's Thor is great, and there are people out there who don't read Usagi Yojimbo.
That's fair, yeah.
Yeah. Grasscutter, but, like... Grasscutter's really good. Like, Grasscutter is great. But, like, you know, we said this when it was brought up. Like, Grasscutter is not that much better than the rest of Usagi Yojimbo, which is not a slight on Grasscutter. It's like, that's how good Usagi Yojimbo is.
True.
Like, Marvel Comics have never been better than Thor.
Like, also true, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, sorry, Stan and Jack, but that Thor run is as good as it gets. The Thor run is as good as superhero comics get. Okay. Is it better than Grasscutter? Is it, Matt? Do you think it is?
It's really hard. It's
and
super
look, we
hard.
Have Gotham Central on here as one story. So, if it's better than Grasscutter.
I don't think it supersedes Gotham Central.
Okay.
But
because Gotham Central, we're talking about the best Joker story ever.
Yeah.
We're talking about Half a Life.
We're talking about the comic that made Renee Montoya a pivotal DC Comics character forever.
Yeah. We're talking about Stacy.
Gotham
Stacy Light in the Bat Signal.
Good Lord, Gotham Central is good.
Gotham Central ain't no fucking joke, man.
Let's put it between Grasscutter and Gotham Central.
All right, give me those issue numbers.
It is Thor numbers 360 through 362.
Ugh.
Benito, you put us through the ringer.
And like Scourge on the Bridge is not the only good thing that happens in that story either.
No, not at all.
Like, Thor has a fist fight with the Goddess of Death in that story,
yeah.
By the way.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's a good... That's Okay, that is a good... That's it. That is where they are.
All
right. That's the end, right?
Yep, that is our June Every Story Ever special. We got it in just under the wire. Thank you to everybody who sent in a list that we used this time. If you would like to send us a list to use on a future Every Story Ever special, you can do so at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That's our email address. Be sure to check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. And be sure to check us out on iTunes. If you search for War Rocket Ajax, you will find the show. If you like the show, leave us a review. The more positive reviews we get, the more we are featured on iTunes. We'll be back in late July with another Every Story Ever special. Before we go, we'll tell you some of the places you can find us on the internet. For me, all you have to do is go to about.me/MattDWilson, and you will find links to all my stuff. Chris, where can people find you?
Everybody can find me at about.me/ChrisSims. There's links there to my Twitter, my Tumblr, and my Comixology author page, where you can find the comics that I write, including Radical Guardian Skater X and X-Men 92 from Marvel Comics, co-written by me and Chad Bowers with art by Scott Koblish, on sale digitally and in print now. And don't forget to get Copernicus Jones, Robot Detective by Matt and Kevin Warren while you're at it.
That's it, everybody. Thanks for
listening.
Those are
tied for number, rank S on this list. Like, above top 10.
Number 1A.
Tied for 1A.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back soon with more Every Story Ever. We'll be back with a regular episode of War Rocket Ajax next week. Talk to you soon.
Forever.
Yeah!
From this day on,
that every breed of mongrel lived together.